You see, they always make themselves known. They always speak to each other in symbols. There is no mystery about any of this if you understand how to read their language. At the highest levels of this initiatory group, there is what's known as the Order of the Trapezoid. The head of the Temple of Set in San Francisco is a member of the Order of Trapezoid. He's also a member of United States Army Intelligence, G2. So is his top two lieutenants in the Temple of Set. What is the Temple of Set? It's the Church of Satan.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Bristol Festival of Establishment Approved Ideas. Why should we pay for a postmodern sham run by the business elite? Bristol's Festival of Ideas is largely funded by the taxpayer, that's us. But the so-called big business charities that part fund and run it ensure really challenging ideas, challenging the status quo, are never given an airing. Should more rightly be called the Bristol Festival of Establishment Approved Ideas. Take tonight's sell-out talk with Guardian columnist Owen Jones, for example. Media and Lens have pointed out glaring gaps in his analysis and have dared to ask, as he speaks in Bristol to a sell-out audience at the festival tonight, is Owen Jones' success due to his keeping his mouth shut on the big issues like media ownership and control and money and land reform that could really make a change? And coal is supposed to be a dirty word, but is it really? There are hundreds of years of it under the ground, and its plentiful supply is the main reason steam was retained on Britain's railways until the 1960s, until the oil industry hatchet man, Dr. Beeching, moved in. Coal was the heart of the matter in the biggest strike Britain has ever seen. Back in 1984 to 1985, a film all about this, called Still the Enemy Within, is airing next week in Bristol. Martin Upchurch is here to tell us why we need to have a cold, hard look at how the strike was broken. Also, former Fraud Squad detective Rowan Bosworth Davis has said it. The annual Cambridge Conference on Financial Crime has said it, and thousands of people who've lost their homes, their farms, and their businesses and their livelihoods have said the financial crime pays, and our banking fraternity is above the law. Most successful banks are often the most crooked, and when they get caught in the act, no directors or senior managers are jailed or even fined. Tonight we hear from one organisation that's bringing the victims together to fight back. That's Jeremy Rowe from Bully Banks. And Jeremy joins me on the line now. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Danny.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into setting up this organisation, Bully Banks?
I'm a small business person. I run holiday cottages and run a health spa in North Devon. And I was sold one of these products. I disputed the product.
Sorry, just let me interrupt you there. What kind of product were you sold?
I was sold something called a swap. It's an interest rate hedging product, and the bank sells it as protection, as insurance, as a very low-risk product. And in fact, in the events that happened during the crash, the product became toxic. The costs that came out of the product were out of all proportion to the benefits of the product itself. And I disputed the consequences with my bank. I'm quite an articulate individual, and I was arguing with my bank, not madly successfully, but, you know, disputing the issue. And then I came across other people who had been missold the same sort of product, and they were less able to look after themselves, and they were losing their homes, they were losing their businesses, and the product was basically sold at a targeted audience. Generally people over 55, 60, 65, 70, and the product was sold to these people because by and large they had significant property assets, because their life's work were in the property assets that were part of their business. The banks targeted them, and when things went wrong, they went wrong in a very big fashion for them.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? But would you say that possibly that these products, as you call them, these deals basically between the banks and borrowers were prepared with some kind of foreknowledge, maybe even that there might be some kind of problem with the banks?
I've argued for 3 years now in public that there's what I call a conscious process of deceit. And I have no doubt at all It was deliberate. It was systematic. People were very aware of what they were doing. And deceit was involved. Deception was involved. Because if the product's true risks are explained, there is no small business person who would enter into them. In very simple terms, if I talk about a million, I mean, some of these products are for much smaller sums, but a million makes a very nice round figure. The bank came to you. The bank, prior to coming to you, had calculated that there was a risk in this product of perhaps 200,000, 250,000. It calculated that risk. It called it a contingent liability, put it into its books. It reduced your borrowing capability, but didn't tell you about that risk. It sold you the product, often through someone who's introduced as an advisor. In fact, he's a very highly paid commission salesman. He sells you the product, no disclosure of this risk, no disclosure of the impact upon your borrowing ability, no disclosure of the cost of exiting the product should you need to. And very often to people, say 50, 55, 60, they sold a 15-year, 20-year, 25-year product. And obviously to business people in that situation, life events are a real fact of life. You know, illness, death, divorce, all sorts of things happen. And there was no disclosure by the banks of the consequences, the cost of exiting this product should you need to.
Well, look, Jeremy, I mean, the banks are going to say, well, sorry, tough, you should have read the small print.
That's what they do say. One of the things that we're told is you took a bet. In reality, no small business person knew they were in the bookmakers. They thought they were talking to their bank as a trusted advisor, and that isn't what happened. And the banks do rely on the small print. There's no question about that. But it is outrageous that they seek to rely on the small print. For any individual, they can't rely on the small print. There's sufficient protection out there. For a small, limited company, they do rely on the small print. But in truth, we are working our way through that. We are dealing with the small print that the banks rely upon, and we're dealing with it quite successfully.
One problem with this, of course, is that we go to independent financial advisors hoping that they're going to be independent. Now, you've just made a pretty strong accusation there that that these people are actually salesmen for the banks. Now, there will have to be some
advisors,
sort of commission, surely, for an independent financial advisor. Otherwise, they wouldn't even talk to you.
No, these are not independent financial advisors. These are people who are employed by the banks. So your bank manager, your relationship manager says, Jeremy, I can't advise you about this, but I'm going to bring someone down from our Treasury Department, a bank employee, who is going to advise you. The whole process is to emphasize the nature of the banking relationship. We, the bank, we're here to advise you. We're here to protect you. We're here to nurture you. We've got your long-term interest at heart. And then they sell a toxic product, and they sell it so that they can make money. There's no dispute at all. There was a much more appropriate product available. The banks didn't want to sell that because they didn't make any money out of it.
Okay, what about your own personal...
Because he didn't make any money out of it.
What about your own personal situation, then? How did it affect you and your family, this?
Well,
and have you managed to come through it yet?
We are coming through it. One of the things is that as a result of bully banks, the FCA set up a redress scheme.
These are the regulators?
Yes, the Financial Conduct Authorities. They set up a redress scheme, and as of 2 days ago, they announced that up until this time, up until the end of September, £1.5 billion, that's £1,500 million, is being paid back by the banks already to small businesses. There's at least another £1.5 billion of potential cost, which has been removed from the small businesses. So you're looking at a return, if you like, already of $3 billion. And that's not enough, in the sense that there are a lot of parties who are still not getting benefit. But this is just one product with one set of costs, and sort of 16,000 small businesses are getting redress. There are another 10,000 which need to get redress in respect of that product. And then there are other issues. I mean, one of the things that has surprised me greatly, when we started this, I started it because I had a conversation with someone who was losing their home and their business, and I thought we might end up with, say, 10,000 people in that sort of situation damaged by the product. In fact, there were 30,000. There's another product. There is misconduct in relation to the sale of fixed interest lending, where people are persuaded by the banks, quite deliberately for the banks' purposes, to change their variable rate lending to go into fixed interest rate lending, and they do it at a moment in time when the banks' predictions are that interest rates are going to drop. And we think there are about 70,000 of those out there. And
I mean, surely that can be considered some kind of insider dealing, because they've got knowledge that the people who are actually making those loans don't have.
It isn't insider dealing in the sense that's a technical offence. What it is abuse of the bank's position. They have the trust of their customers, or at least we say they did have the trust. And what has happened is they've betrayed that trust. And over the last 5, 6, 7 years, a lot of people have realised that the banks are on a frolic of their own and they're not to be relied upon, they're not to be trusted. But they took advantage of the trust that was bestowed upon them, and that is right at the heart of everything, is that abuse. And it's driven by greed, simple, naked greed. That is what drives the bank's individual staff members, and they have abused the confidence that their customers have in the bank. And I mean, we know there are issues in LIBOR, we know there are interest with PPI mis-selling, we know there's issues with foreign exchange, and all of those have got massive aggregate consequences. The problem with the sale of interest rate hedging products and fixed interest rate loans is, though they have a very large aggregate consequence, for the individuals involved, the consequences are devastating.
Okay, well, tell us about some of your members, because I know you've got a membership on your website, bully-banks.co.uk. Small businesses can pay £200 a year to become members, and large businesses £600. But give us an idea of a couple of case studies that you've done of individual people who have come to you.
Extract it sort of as general examples. You know, our members, they're farmers, they're owners of care homes, they're owners of holiday cottages, they're owners of hotels, small factories. We've got doctors and dentists who've set up facilities. We have childcare, and we've got sort of landlords, people who are doing buy for let. There's a whole range of businesses out there. The examples, I sort of quickly trip into examples because I've personally spoken to over 500 businesses where people have spent quite a bit of time talking to me about their problems. You know, a couple of ladies running a caravan park, coming up to their early 60s. They actually inherited the caravan park from their parents, and what happened is that the banks came and sold them a product. They didn't disclose the consequence of the product. I mean, these ladies are not financially sophisticated, and they lose everything. You know, they're pawning their jewellery, they're selling their furniture, they've sold their home in order to meet the costs that come with this product. I was at one conference near Manchester, and a guy comes up in the audience. We'd had a conference about 300 or 400 people there, and he comes up, and a young guy in his mid 30s, and he sort of talks, and he says, "Look, I've got real problems with my bank," and he's explaining it, and he had about 50 separate small buy-to-let properties, you know, residential homes, which he said, I bought for about £50,000, etc. I've got about 50 of them, and he said they're now worth about 150, and so, you know, you think, well, yep, this guy is doing very well, he's been very successful. He's a wealthy individual. And he sort of carried on talking. He said, "The problem is I've got this swap. I was sold the swap for several million." In other words, it's a product that's associated with a loan. He's got a loan of a couple of million. He's sold this swap. And the swap, the costs, basically are driving into bankruptcy. And he said, "I'm having to sell my properties in order to survive the process. But what happens is when I sell a property, the bank grabs all the money. So I sell a property for 150, the bank just takes the money. So I can't pay my estate agent. The solicitor takes his fees before it goes, but I can't pay the estate agent. More importantly, I can't pay the tax man because I've got a capital gains bill on that.
Sounds like it's forcing people... Sorry to interrupt you, but it sounds like it's forcing people into... basically to the law, so that people are then going to... They're going to be made basically illegal. Slow, you know, that they will be put into debt, etc., and that there will be various people taking them to court.
Well, there are. In fact, the one who takes them to court most of all is the tax man. And I mean, this guy, let me finish the story just very quickly.
Sure, yeah.
At the end of it, and I couldn't understand why the bank is doing this, and then he says, and actually he says, I'm on the transplant list. I've got a heart-lung transplant. And actually, the guy, that guy, he got redress. The bank paid him several hundred thousand pounds for a missold product, and he contacts me, and he says, Jeremy, many thanks. I've got the redress. I can pay that my mum back, the debt. And I can sort my daughter at university, but actually it's too late for me to get a heart transplant now. I'm, you know, off the register because I'm no longer in sufficient condition to benefit from that transplant. And you have that sort of personal tragedy. Obviously that's extreme, but that's the sort of thing which, if it were, I call life events. There's reality out there. You know, all the sorts of things that people take for granted, you know, illness, divorce, death, etc., in the family, and you have a situation in which small businesses are saddled with a product for many years that devastates their business, and while that's happening, all their life events are taking place around them.
Okay, what are you actually able to do for people? Because I understand that you've had some sort of conference get-together over the last couple of weeks, for example.
Yes, that was on LPA receivers. There are a whole series of scandals out there. There's the misconduct of the bank's business support teams. There's the misconduct of LPA receivers.
Okay, just tell us about the receivers, because these are the guys that come in when someone tells you, whether it's true or not, that your company is bankrupt. And
those are insolvency practitioners. They're different. LPA receivers is just it's an odd quirk of English law. What happens is when you... give a mortgage to the bank on your property, and it can be your home or your business property, if you get into arrears, they can send in someone who takes control of the property. And they're called receivers. And what happens is, because a business that's property has been taken over is generally financially vulnerable, the conduct of the professionals who go in and take over the property is often unchallenged, and over a period of years, these individuals can become, they're not all of them, obviously, but individuals can become corrupted, if you like, by the power that they have, and their behaviour can be very distressing for the individuals involved.
So they're like little Hitlers coming in.
Absolutely, you're quite right, it's exactly what it's like. And again, you can think, these may be people, you know, with a £100,000 mortgage on a property, and they find they're in difficulties. The property is taken out of their hands by an LPA receiver, and the conduct of the receiver in those situations can become something that is really reprehensible. And with all of these things, what is reasonable to start with, if it's if someone has power and it's unchecked and they begin to think they're above the law, over a period of time, their behaviour becomes misconduct, and the misconduct can have tremendous damage, can cause tremendous damage, and that is what we're seeing. In fact, the West Country, I think, is a bit of a focus of behaviour by LPA receivers, which I think should be thoroughly reviewed. If I describe it as misconduct, it's sort of a neutral word. There are allegations that it's much worse than just misconduct, but it certainly requires investigation. And in terms of who should investigate it, ultimately it has to be the police, the SFO, and that has to be prompted by politicians. And we're out there trying to do our bit in getting the politicians to pay attention to the issue, and we do that by Getting our members as a group to go and see their MPs. It's not one or two people, it's 2,000 people across the country going to see their MPs in their constituencies and talking about the issues that are real here and which we require political support. And
okay, Jeremy, I'm going to have to interrupt you because you're set up for small businesses. What about individuals that have had particular trouble with banks? Because I've noticed around Bristol, I was in Stroud a few weeks ago and saw someone had put a brick into the window of one of the Stroud banks. People are obviously getting quite angry with the banks.
I think you're in the wrong tense. I think people are angry with the banks. And it's simply we say to people, come, we've got a website, it's Bully Banks, there's a hyphen in the web title, bullybanks.co.uk. Come, go to the website, read about us, look at what we're doing, and we are trying to help. I mean, there's all of the directors are people who've been missold these products. No one is making money out of it. We've got no political allegiance, we've got no commercial allegiance. We are just a group of individuals. We started very much as business focused. It is broadening. One of the scandals that we have is equity participation, where banks enter an arrangement with people whereby they take a share of the growth in their property. And we have real concerns about the conduct of banks there.
Okay, what about going to put you in the driving seat now, in George Osborne's job. If you were sitting there in charge of the economy, looking also, of course, over the entire regulation of the financial markets and the banking system, what would you be doing, Jeremy?
First thing I'd do, actually, is I'd call in the chief executives and the chairman of every bank and talk to them very seriously about what they have to do to resolve the outstanding issues. And there's no question I could run through a dozen issues which require urgent attention. The banks are aware of them, but the banks are much more aware of their bottom line. They're much more aware of their shareholders. In terms of sort of structurally the change, I do think there has to be change in the way the banks publish data about themselves, about the complaints they receive, etc. The Financial Ombudsman Service has to have its authority increased quite significantly, and that requires a growth in the FOS. The FCA's powers have to be extended. They have to change the way in which the courts work on these issues. For example, gagging orders. They're abused woefully by the banks to create a precedent which is adverse to the customer and protects the bank.
Now, George Osborne, actually the taxpayer, owns great shares in some of these many banks.
Oh, yes.
Why is he not doing these things?
I think there is a mythology which the banks helped perpetrate. The banks present themselves in a way to government which is that the banks are businesses which are terribly, terribly successful and you can't afford to damage them. The most important thing about the banks is that they have control of our currency, our money, and the whole economy. All of the thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses which employ multitudes more than the banks, who are absolutely essential for this country in terms of what they produce, they depend upon the money, and the banks have the money in their control. And if you strike out the money, I mean, the banks are not responsible for making widgets or making cars or computers. They have control of our money, and they have a different social responsibility because of that. And one of their social responsibilities is to moderate their remuneration. The only reason these people pay themselves such exorbitant amounts of money is because their remuneration is determined by bankers and not by ordinary people. I mean, I'm sure you have a pension fund, I have a pension fund, but I don't manage it in reality. Bankers manage that fund, and they are the voice of the shareholder that determines, yes, the bankers can pay themselves more money, yes, these bonus payments are appropriate. Look at the banks. Look at what proportion of their their net income is paid out to their employees in the way of bonuses. It is fundamentally wrong that those individuals are entitled to that level, that proportion of remuneration compared to what the shareholders receive.
Amazing, as well, as we were hearing earlier on, it looks like they're killing the economy in the process.
I think there is a major structural inequality in the economy. You ask what I'd do if I was George Osborne, I'd actually grow up. I'd turn around, I'd look at what the hell's going on in this country, and I'd say certain things have got to change, and one of the most important things to change is the conduct of the banks, and you have to change it in a very fundamental way. The banks are driven by greed, and again, it's not... I don't think I'm a better man than a banker. What I think is if you put a banker and you put an individual like me into a situation where the rewards are extraordinary, it's likely that our behaviour will be the same, because we are all motivated by money. Do you know what I mean? That's a fact of life. And you have such massive reward going to the banks, totally unprincipled, totally exceptional, and their behaviour changes, their conduct changes. They disregard the normal, if you like, ethics which should govern the way in which we relate to other people. I'm a grandfather, okay? I've got a certain distance on these things. Money's a lot less important to me than it was when I was 20, when I was 30, etc. There's no question I could see myself corrupted by the vast amounts of money which these bankers pay to large numbers of their staff.
Okay.
And it is an issue for this country. It really is an issue.
Okay. That was Jeremy Rowe. Thanks very much, Jeremy.
Okay,
from Bully Banks, your website is bully-banks.co.uk.
Yep.
And you have a helpline as well that people can call.
Yes, we do.
Do you have to be a member to call the helpline? Let me just give the helpline number, Jeremy. It's 01202 701047. That's 01202 701047. And do you have any events coming up in the next couple of weeks?
Well, what's happening, quite interesting again, is we've got our fourth parliamentary debate. We've been in the House of Commons twice and the Westminster Hall once. We've got another debate coming up about the issue of the misconduct of the banks, and that will take place at the end of October, early November. It's been prompted by the all-party parliamentary group, which was set up because of the missale of interest rate hedging products, and Gita Beb is the chairman of that group, and he is with his colleagues of the group prompting for another debate. And this is really specific about the failure of the Financial Conduct Authority to do its job, to properly regulate the banks and to provide appropriate redress when a clear, undisputed misconduct occurs by the banks on a grand scale.
Okay, Jeremy Rowe from Bully Banks. Helpline again, 01202 701047. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much, Tony. Cheers.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist. What would be your fix for the banks if you were in George Osborne's position? Because it does seem that they're not really using the public shareholding to discipline them.
No, well, when you had the Labour government, and even more with the coalition, the view was that these were basically private sector institutions, and that if the government was to intervene in these institutions, it would undermine the whole wall that there's supposed to be between private business and the public sector. Pretty bizarre if you think about it. But in other words, although the government is a majority shareholder on the board of RBS, they deliberately designed the situation so that they wouldn't have any influence, because that would... That would send the wrong signals to the City of London and so on and so forth. And if you think of the kind of the sort of during the crisis, the Labour government was desperate to avoid nationalising the banks, so they didn't want to do it. Whereas in actual fact, if they were actually true to their original principles, they'd have regarded it as an opportunity to take the banks over and do what they wanted with them. But of course, they didn't want to be seen to be doing
that.
Is
it just as simple as George Osborne not being tough enough to stand up to these guys?
Well, George Osborne represents their interests, so he's basically their shop steward. So that's why he does what he does. It's because that's what he's there for.
And is there ever any chance, do you think, of banking becoming a utility where money is there to actually serve the population rather than to enslave us?
Well, Ellen Brown's got the Public Banking Institute, I think it's called, in the US, and the Bank of North Dakota is her model, and that was set up in 1919.
Okay, but what about here? Any chance of banking becoming a proper utility again, like it should be?
Well, not this side of the crash, but of course the crash is coming. We were talking in the first hour about the reform of the banks, and I think that reform is by the by now. There's going to be a crash, and then we will see what we're going to do.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And I'm joined by Martin Upchurch now, who's here to talk about coal. Martin, what is going on next week?
Well, what is going on next week is a film called Still the Enemy Within, which is showing at the Cube Cinema Monday and Tuesday, and I think at the Curzon Cinema in Clevedon on Tuesday. And the film is 30 years on from the great miners' strike, and is full of interviews, original footage and political commentary, backed with some real good 1980s ska music from The Specials, for example. It's a very good film, being put together by a group of people who wanted really partly to remember and also to celebrate the greatest and longest major strike in Britain that there's ever been.
Now, I was talking to a former miner earlier this week, and their memories seem to be still there about this strike. You saying it was really the biggest strike we've had in Britain? I think it lasted for a year. Why was it so important?
I think it was important because it was more than just a strike. It was actually a challenge by the fairly new Margaret Thatcher government on the most organised section of the British Labour movement. The miners historically had been at the centre of the big rises in strikes throughout Britain, whether it was the great so-called labour unrest way back in 1910, 1914, the big general strike in 1926, and then again in the 1970s, of course, when two major miners' strikes, the second one in 1974, actually brought down the Conservative government. So I think what the Thatcher government were wanting to do was actually to break the miners as a symbolic section of resistance in order to clear the ground for the sorts of things we've just been hearing about in the last interview about bankers going on a spree of spending and an orgy of corporate profit making. And so that was what the strike was about, and it was preceded, of course, by a number of other strikes on softer targets, for example, the British Leyland, the car factory in Birmingham, the Iron and Steel Codes Federation, a big steel strike in 1980, then health workers and civil servants. So I think the government planned and always knew that the miners would be the big one. And a big one it certainly was.
What about this term, The Enemy Within? Why is that part of the title of the film?
Because I think The Enemy Within was a phrase coined by Mrs. Thatcher, really with the conservative argument of the time that the British working class, or the organised sections, the trade unions, were actually holding up reform, market reform in Britain. And that this was therefore a bad thing, and what she wanted to do in a period of declining profitability for corporations, it must be said, was to open the door for a more free run for corporations, businesses to make profits, and that meant that you actually had to break the resistance of the British working class. So that's why she called it The Enemy Within. It was a class act, and of course, she must be recognised for being a supreme class warrior for her side of the argument.
Some see Margaret Thatcher as actually a bit prophetic by dismantling the mining industry, since coal is so very, very big contributor towards climate change, global warming, that sort of thing, that actually coal was a dead duck.
Well, interestingly, just over a half of British energy supply still comes from coal, and I don't think that was the reason for Thatcher's offensive against the miners. Most of the coal, of course, is now imported from Poland and Australia. It wasn't to do with the environment. I don't think she gave a toss about the environment, quite honestly. I think it was much more to do with breaking the British Labour movement.
This miner I was chatting to earlier in the week was saying that he felt that it was worth fighting for because generations of his family had fought for decent conditions down the mines, and when they'd finally achieved that in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, those mines were then closed and coal was mined abroad where there was actually no health and safety, no decent conditions, no rules and regulations at all.
Mm. Yes, I'm sure it's an horrific industry. My grandfather was a miner, and if you go back to the 1926 period when the general strike, 1 in 10 of British men were miners. It was a core feature of any British working man's, it was man's, life. I think one of the things that has to be said is around that core feature of coal mining, communities were created. And if you go back to those old mining communities, whether it be in South Wales or Yorkshire or Scotland, where coal mines used to be, what you find are devastated communities where people have remained jobless for many years on benefits, so on and so forth. It was actually, I think, a human tragedy as well as a tragedy just in terms of industrial relations.
Wasn't it just part of the entire deindustrialisation of Britain? I mean, Britain used to be a manufacturing, producing country. Nowadays, all we seem to have is service industries, things like call centres, and very little manufacturing. And we have vast areas of land which were made derelict. Now some have had housing estates on, but it's been a complete deindustrialisation.
This is true, and it raises the question whether that is a good or a bad thing. Do we want a society in Britain which is still dependent and has a core manufacturing sector and all the supply industries which would surround that?
Well, it's jobs, I think, is the main thing that manufacturing but people will look back and say, well, back in the 1960s, for example, it was very easy to get a job. You could leave one day and get another job the next.
Yes, that's right. And that was partly because the economy was much more buoyant and diverse. And one of the things I think that has happened with the growth, for example, of finance as an employer, the City of London, I think, employs about 300,000 people. There's a couple of 100,000 people just employed in the Bristol, Bath, Gloucester triangle alone in finance. I mean, those types of jobs have certainly arisen, but of course we've seen with the financial crash that there's a certain amount of instability with those jobs as well, and they don't actually produce anything which is long lasting. You know, if I'm an old socialist, and I know that, you know, wealth and comes from things being made by people that actually are products that you can feel and hold and use, whereas the finance sector really just recirculates the money from the profits out of those manufacturing things. And I think what we've done is in Britain is moved to that second sort of economy and made it much more unstable.
So let's cut to the chase. How was the strike broken by the Thatcher government?
I think there were a number of things. I think it's more interesting in many ways to ask why the strike wasn't won. And I think there are a number of factors for that. One, of course, was that right at the beginning of the strike, campaigns in Nottinghamshire would have, or better campaigning by the National Union of Mine Workers in Nottinghamshire may have helped prevent the Nottinghamshire section of the union breaking away and continuing to produce coal. Secondly, there were two key points in the strike, one in July in 1984 with an imminent dock strike which could have given massive support to the miners, and secondly the supervisors union in October who very nearly voted to come out on strike, and that would have closed all the pits including the ones in Nottinghamshire and held up coal. And I think also if there had been more support from the British trade union movement generally, rank and file ordinary workers responded by donating hundreds of thousands of pounds to the miners, twinning with pits and so on and so forth from workplaces. But that level of support wasn't reciprocated by the leaders either of the Labour Party or the TUC. So really the miners, just as they in 1926, were left very much to fight alone against the full force of the British state, riot police, a deliberate plan to starve miners back to work, for example. even the benefits were withdrawn from many miners. Even one miner's family had benefits, funeral benefits withdrawn for one of their sons who had died. These types of offensives from the state, which were almost unprecedented, eventually helped to break the strike. And quite honestly, miners went to back to work, much in debt, and many of them very, very near to having no food at all in the cupboard.
Well, given the lesser role that unions play today and, as I said, the deindustrialisation of the country, is there actually any point of poring over the bones of this old strike? Is there any real lessons worth learning?
Yes, I think there is. I think one key lesson is the value of solidarity. I mean, I'm very struck by other, not quite similar films. I was thinking of the Made in Dagenham film, which came out a few years ago celebrating the 1968 women's equal pay strike in the Ford Dagenham factory. It's now been turned into a West End play with Gemma Arterton appearing in it. The Durham Miners Gala, which you would have thought would have, which is a huge gala that takes place up in Durham of all the old miners' lodges, once a year, you would have assumed that would have declined in support, but in actual fact it's increasing its support. More people now attend the Durham Miners Gala than 10 years ago, and I think the reasons are for that is that people want in their communities a sense of solidarity. It's almost a yearning for that sense of solidarity against a very oppressive, a very individualised society that's emerged in the last 20, 30 years. Of course, academics call it neoliberalism, but that's a very distinct form of individual society where solidarity is broken. And that was what the miners' strike, from the government's perspective, was alike to actually break that community solidarity, whether you be in the workplace or whether you be just amongst friends and family.
What about the future, though? Because I wonder what, you know, you're looking at. I mean, we had actually, you were saying that your grandfather was a miner. We had big coal mines down here in Somerset, for example, Radstock, massive mining area. I just wonder what you think the relevance of this is for the future, and if you can see through to a better future, because at the moment we're in a situation where there's a massive gulf opening up between an elite with more money than they know what to do with or could ever spend, and people who are having to queue a million now, having to go over a period of a couple of years now. I think it's actually a million families per year are now having to access, or nearly a million, food banks to get food because they're being cut off from their benefits. So what can we do about all this?
Well, I think the problem of rising inequality and a detached elite that's on, as the last speaker was talking about, huge bonus payments, is a direct product of the inability of ordinary people, through their trade unions and through their collective solidarity, to keep a check on the way society has developed. Now, if you want to challenge the elites, if you want to get back to a situation where there's less inequality rather than more, there has to be pressure on politicians from below in order to make that happen. And that means actually reviving the trade unions wherever they be, whether they be in call centres or whether they be in financial services. You know, the composition of the working class constantly changes. It's not that the working class is dead, it's just that it constantly changes.
But the ruling elite are pretty smart, aren't they? If they see a union forming sometimes, they will just sack and they'll find an excuse to dismiss people. And this is one of the problems with having this great pool of unemployed, is that it's very easy to find someone who's not unionised to fill those shoes.
Well, thus it ever has been. And over the history of Labour, of course, it's always been a struggle against those very employers' tactics. I think employers generally would like a totally insecure workforce, one that's on no contract or a zero contract that they could manipulate at will. And of course, when you look back in the 1950s, for example, that was often, you know, in immediate post-war period, that was essentially the situation. But then you got the growth of trade union organisation through the 50s into the 60s and 70s, and gradually job security increased. Now what we've seen, of course, is a reversal of that process. So it's really a balance of forces, and I think what Thatcher did successfully was tip the balance of forces towards the employer and towards the power of capital and the banks. So it's really a question of tipping the balance of forces backwards again the other way, if we are to get a more secure environment and better jobs, better wages, and so on and so forth.
After all, we do have the numbers.
We certainly do have the numbers, yes.
Okay, just tell us when this is on, where again next week, including the Clevedon one.
Yes, I don't say the Clevedon one is on the same night as the main showing in Bristol, which is Tuesday the 21st at Clevedon. I think it's the Curzon Cinema, 7:30, same time at the Cube Cinema in Bristol, 7:30 on Tuesday, where there'll be a question and answer session afterwards with one of the film's producers and hopefully a couple of ex-miners. It's sold out, the Tuesday session at the Cube, and so the Cube have now put on a Monday evening showing as well. So you can still get tickets either direct from the cinema or through the Facebook event page that's been set up.
Okay, that's off just round the back of King's Square, isn't it? Which is just off Jamaica Street.
And it's only a fiver, by the way.
Martin Upchurch, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Martin, Owen Jones is actually a very good left-wing journalist. He wrote something I thought absolutely brilliant recently about the BBC and all the right-wing conservative connections of many of the BBC's key political staff. For example, the political editor, Andrew Neil, being running the Spectator magazine, as being somebody who's on the Daily Politics show, the producer of that show as well, a conservative. But there are some problems with him too, aren't there? I mean, for example, over Syria, apparently he was instrumental in actually getting someone who'd come across from Syria banned from a conference by the Stop the War meeting. So anyway, just tell us a little bit about Owen Jones.
Well, I don't know that much about him, Tony, but in actual fact, he is quite a good journalist, quite a young journalist. But of course, there are always people are varied in their interests and what have you. And people like him, and a bit like George Monbiot in The Guardian as well, they kind of define the limit of what is acceptable to liberal opinion. So in those terms, he's regarded as a bit of a radical. But in actual fact, of course, from a more radical perspective, he's actually a bit of a conservative. So, for example, on Syria, he got Sister Mariam, I think she's called Sister Mariam, banned from a conference because she was basically arguing that the rebels in Syria were actually killing Christians. She was opposed to it, and that the regime, Bashar al-Assad regime, bad as it was a better alternative than the rebels. And that didn't suit bien pensant liberal opinion in Britain at the time. Although, interestingly, of course, it's all turned around now, and the rebels have suddenly become the worst thing since Hitler. Of course, this time last year, they were heroes to people like Owen Jones.
The main criticism has actually been levelled by a group called Media Lens. So they're on Facebook, Twitter, etc. And I've been following them on and off for years. But they're really laying into Jones, saying that in his book about the establishment, he's completely failed to tackle the immense amount of power the establishment has in controlling the media, The Guardian particularly, which he's now a part of.
Well, what you find in anybody, either radical academics or radical journalists, is that they get a sinecure. You are, basically, you've got a living saying the kind of things you want to say, provided you don't go too far and saw off the branch you're sitting on. And, of course, you'll find that when it comes to the crunch, these people tend to go along with establishment views about things because it's part of the culture and it's also part of self-preservation. And in a way, you can hardly blame people. If he was actually to write stuff that The Guardian wouldn't print, eventually he'd lose his job and he'd end up on a radio station like this and with no money in his pocket at all, wouldn't he?
I know that a similar sort of thing, at least allegedly, has happened to Nafees Ahmed, who was a regular columnist on The Guardian.
Well, he's the other way. He's been removed from The Guardian because he actually says things that they don't want to hear. So that's a bit different.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Thanks for making my point for me, because do you think that's the way the London media works then? Is that there are actually certain lines, if you step over them, you're not allowed to be heard there? Because actually that sounds to me like what they're doing is a massive gatekeeping job on the national debate.
Yeah, well, that's what some would say about people like George Monbiot and Owen Jones, is that they are gatekeepers. They define what radical liberal opinion is allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. And I'm afraid it was ever thus. You're always going to have a choice, are you not, in any walk of life, about how far you're prepared to really stand up for your principles and how far you have to bend with the wind in order to stay in place. I mean, ultimately, if you're just talking to yourself, you're not achieving anything. So, you know, being pure and radical and not communicating with anybody is also a mistake. So inevitably, people have to make decisions and choices about the kind of things they're going to say and how far they're prepared to go.
One of the things Media Lens point out is that WikiLeaks, in his book, The Establishment and Julian Assange, never get a mention. Edward Snowden and the NSA are mentioned once in a single paragraph. The establishment's recent catastrophic overthrowing of the Libyan government is also unmentioned. Libya receives one comment in passing. Syria, the great establishment target before ISIS, gets four brief mentions. So what's happening, he's saying, is essentially that Owen Jones is doing here is leaving out a very important area of the national debate. Ultimately, though, is there anything we can do about this? This is the main point. I understand what you're saying is that Owen Jones wants to keep a job, but is there anything we can do about this to break this monopolistic power of the London media to act as gatekeepers in this way, if that's what's happening?
Well, I mean, we're doing it now on this community radio station.
The fact is that
what's happening is that the mainstream media is dying. The Guardian doesn't make any money. The Telegraph doesn't make any money. The Times doesn't make any money. The only thing that makes money is things like The Sun.
If it doesn't make any money, how on earth does it survive? Is it just propped up by lending, by banks?
The Guardian survives because it's got a huge trust fund that it inherited, which is basically running down. I mean, Suzanne Moore, who's a journalist on The Guardian, was here a few years ago and pointing out that Alan Rusbridger, who's the editor, has got no strategy for solving the financial problems of The Guardian. So in other words, it kind of exists on sufferance. And the Telegraph and the Times exist because Murdoch and the Barclay brothers want it to exist to push their views. That's it. And most serious journalism in this country is funded by the wealthy as a hobby, which means, of course, that the journalists who work for them have to say the kind of things that they want to hear, otherwise they're out of a job.
OK, let's wind up, though, by talking about the Festival of Ideas. I've called it, jokingly, the Festival of Establishment-Approved Ideas because of the way that it seems to get at these big London figures, bring them down to Bristol, and that's the end of it. You know, that's the end. There are no other ideas other than these gate-kept thoughts. And this is partly funded by the taxpayer, but it's actually driven by the business community who are in partnership with public money.
Well, I mean, this twas ever thus. You're going to find a situation that he who pays the piper calls the tune. And of course, you've got
But that's us, the public. We're paying the piper. We're taxpayers.
Yes, and of course, there is obviously an element. Yes, but if you go into public-private partnerships with the private sector, they're going to have something to say about what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. It's inevitable that there is going to, in any case, people are entitled to their views. Owen Jones is entitled to his views, however wrong we may think that they are. And of course, many of his views are not wrong. Some of them I'm not happy with, some of them I am. But of course, he's still entitled to his views, and in many ways, attacking him when there's all these other basically incredibly nasty people in the rest of the media is rather missing the point. You know, Fox News and the Telegraph and the Sun are far worse than Owen Jones.
I would just recommend, though, keeping an eye on Media Lens, medialens.org. They really are not gatekept, and they criticise a lot of some of the stuff that was coming down from London in the press. Anyway, Martin, thanks for helping us with that little report.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the book's called Iran, A Manufactured Crisis. The author is Gareth Porter. He's a US author. Martin, it seems to take a long time. This is several years now to come out of the woodwork, but it's becoming pretty clear now that the whole entire idea of Iran trying to make a nuclear weapon that we've been hearing on the news again and again and again, repeated by government, by the press, is a load of nonsense. It's actually been manufactured.
Yes, I don't think there's any strong evidence that the Iranians are trying to develop nuclear weapons at all. They aren't trying to develop nuclear power, and they've always said that they are. But I don't think there's any strong evidence to suggest that they're developing nuclear weapons, although, of course, that is the Israeli position, because they want to attack the Iranians, and they need an excuse to do it.
Interestingly enough, Gareth Porter, the author, is saying that the International Atomic Energy Authority's evidence that they've presented about Iran is actually just Israeli intelligence documents with a different stamp on the top of them. So let's have a listen to him now.
The crucial role that the documents played in this manufactured crisis was to allow the IAEA, indeed to put pressure on the IAEA, to accuse Iran of having had a a covert nuclear weapons program, that would then be cited as the basis for some international action. It would be the basis for taking Iran to the United Nations Security Council, where the United States could either get support for military action, carry out military action unilaterally on the basis of the case that had been made through the IAEA, or they could organize sanctions against Iran as an intermediary step. Of course, that is finally what happened in 2012. And crucially, it was an IAEA report based on more documents and more intelligence issued in November 2011 that was supposed to set the stage for organizing that coalition. We know that the Obama administration was consciously working with the Israelis on a time frame in which the kickoff was going to be the issuance of that IAEA report of November 2011, which is still being cited now as sort of the gold standard of information about the Iranian nuclear program. The crucial thing that you need to know about the IAEA report of November 2011 is that it is almost entirely based on documents and intelligence that came from Israel. We know this from Mohammed El-Baradei, the former director general of the IAEA. In his memoirs, he talks about a whole raft of new documents that were given by Israel to the IAEA in 2009.
That was Gareth Porter, author of Iran, A Manufactured Crisis. Time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. On Monday's sister show Dialect at 11 a.m, you can hear how the Allies' fear of communism persuaded them to do secret wartime deals with the Nazis, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor Rob Telford. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. You can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let those banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, four men have appeared in court accused of planning a terror attack on police officers or soldiers in London. They face a total of 21 charges, including allegedly swearing allegiance to Islamic State. Our reporter Ashish Joshi is at Westminster Magistrates Court and says they were also charged with scouting out potential targets.
Using Google Street View of two alleged targets. One is the White City Territorial Army Barracks, and the other one is Shepherd's Bush Police Station.
A fifth man's accused of firearms offences. They'll all appear in court again in 10 days. The head of the World Bank says we're losing the battle against Ebola. Jim Yong Kim thinks it's because of a lack of international solidarity, with some countries, in his words, only worried about their own borders. US Secretary of State John Kerry agrees that closer cooperation is needed.
No one country is going to resolve this problem by themselves. This is going to take a collective global response, all hands on deck.
Earlier, the World Health Organization admitted it messed up attempts to prevent the outbreak in West Africa, partly blaming incompetent staff. Nigeria's presidency says it's agreed to a ceasefire with the militant group Boko Haram that could see the release of more than 200 kidnapped girls. The group abducted them at gunpoint from a school in April, provoking international outrage. Oscar Pistorius will have to wait until Tuesday to hear whether he'll spend time in prison for the manslaughter of his girlfriend. In his final appeal, his defence lawyer said the athlete was broken and had lost everything. And the actress Dame Maggie Smith has been honoured by the Queen for her 60-year career on stage and screen.
Dame Maggie Smith for services to drama.
The 79-year-old, who's known for her role in Downton Abbey, has been made a member of the Order of the Companions of Honour. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.